This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa. JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharyson, the editor-in-chief over at numberfire.com, and this is episode 134 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the Number Fire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. Seahawks beat writer Greg Bell sent out a tweet on Wednesday that had a picture of Seattle's new offensive coordinator Brian Schottenheimer sporting a visor. And the tweet read, "Multiple times, new offensive coordinator Brian Schottenheimer says the key for Seahawks offense to improve and win games is to run the ball when defenses know they are going to run it in 2018. Take a step back and think about what this NFL offensive coordinator is saying, you guys. He thinks the way to improve an offense with Russell Wilson is to run the ball when defenses know they are going to run it. Now, I agree that Seattle has to run the ball better than they did in 2017. You guys know how I feel about teams feeling this urge to pound the rock despite it being 2018 and data screaming at us and telling us that passing is far more efficient than rushing. But Seattle really was bad on the ground last year. They need some improvement there. The real issue here is causation and overcompensation. I went to Twitter with general thoughts on this issue and made a bad joke about it, but after doing so, this flock of Seahawks fans entered my mentions with a lot of the same talk. They first told me to watch the games because clearly if I question Brian Schottenheimer's reasoning, I'm not watching football. But they also referenced the Seahawks teams over the last 5 years that have been really good, and they attributed that success to having a good run game. So let's look at 2013 and 2014 specifically, the 2 years that the Seahawks went to the Super Bowl. In 2014, Seattle was indeed first in per-play rush efficiency, according to NumberFire's metrics. In 2013, they were 12th. Over the last 2 seasons, Seattle's ranked 21st and 23rd in per-rush efficiency. Now, you may be scratching your head as to how in the world Seattle ranked 21st last season in rushing efficiency, but it's because of Russell Wilson. I'm looking at our expected points model here, and expected points doesn't care who's running the football. It only cares about the impact that each rush has. And generally speaking, quarterbacks can make a huge impact on the ground, oftentimes a bigger impact than running backs can. Regardless, though, these Seahawks fans are right to point out the correlation between Seattle's overall success on the ground and making legitimate Super Bowl runs. The problem, though, is causation. Is running the reason the Seahawks were successful, or one of the many reasons? Looking back, during those two Super Bowl runs, Seattle ranked 3rd and 1st in per-play defensive efficiency. Last year, they were 12th. And what's interesting is that if you compare their 2013 Super Bowl winning team to the one last year, the difference in rushing effectiveness was 0.04 expected points per play. So each time they ran last year, they were losing 0.04 expected points versus what they saw in 2013. The difference in per-play defensive efficiency, though, from 2013 to 2017 was 0.10. In other words, the disparity between defenses versus the difference between rushing offenses was much greater. It was 2.5 times greater. This is why my response to the Seahawks fans was that the main reason Seattle did what they did wasn't just because of some running game. It was because they had an elite defense. The running game helped, as did Russell Wilson's efficiency. And that's really important too. There's always talk that running the ball makes life easier on a quarterback. And while I don't think that's completely untrue, it makes a lot more sense to equate offensive success to the aspect of the game that's impacting the outcome more. And that's passing. It's no different than when people say running the football gives the defense rest because running extends drives and therefore you hold on to the ball longer. But that's not true either. There's been studies done, specifically studies done by Ben Baldwin of The Athletic, that proves that that's not true. I mean, you don't even necessarily need a study to intuitively understand that throwing the ball and converting third downs extends drives, but for whatever reason, the masses just think of this old school pound the rock style when thinking about ball control. And if you think Ben's analysis or my analysis on the subject is somewhat flawed, at least come back with analysis proving it otherwise. That's the thing with all of this. That's what all of these rants that I go on during these mailbag shows really come down to. It'd be one thing if these coaches stood at the podium and gave detail as to why a certain philosophy works. If Brian Schottenheimer came with reasons as to why they should run the ball as much as humanly possible, and if those reasons made sense, then go for it. Run the football. Win games because you're running the football. But they're not. Coaches are feeding garbage takes to fans, and then fans believe them because fans are fans. They believe in their teams, the coaches who are running those teams, and the front offices who are making decisions on how to build those teams. Fans aren't stepping back and asking why enough. Why, Mr. Schottenheimer, do you need to run the football so much? What's the logic behind it? What's the reasoning? Where's the data to support your claim? Like, if we want to equate this to the fantasy football world, what Brian Schottenheimer and so many other coaches across the league are doing is writing an article on fantasy football sleepers, listing out the players, and giving literal zero evidence as to why they like those players. How is that acceptable? How are you fans okay with this? Until we start seeing these questions answered, until we get intelligent responses to team building and game planning, analysts like myself are going to continue to criticize. Because that's what we're supposed to do. And in doing so, our goal is to help educate fans and make the whole football watching experience that much more enjoyable. Anyway, this is a mailbag episode, so let's get to these questions. This first question is from @FreddyBoots on Twitter. Love your work. Mailbag question. Is average draft position a more accurate way to approach drafts versus rankings? If you're talking about average draft position being more predictive than a rankings list, it depends on how good that rankings list is. So that's kind of an impossible thing to answer. You use average draft position, though, to maximize your return with each pick that you make. If you know you're selecting a player four rounds above his average cost, for instance, then you also know that you can probably wait a couple of rounds to make that pick. And I'm not saying that as in you should only draft players at their ADP. But you do need to balance ADP with your own forecast in order to maximize your roster's potential. Average draft position is just market value. It's telling you how the majority of people view something. A lot of times, your rankings will more or less correlate with what the market value is saying. But in the instances where they don't, you should utilize ADP to optimize each selection. This next question says, "Hey JJ, huge fan of your work and proud to be on team #processoverresults. I've developed a theory over the years that in my own main league, the best place to take advantage of market inefficiencies is in trading. My league is a 10-team standard with a lot of guys who take it seriously, but end up making mostly chalk moves in the draft and on waivers. I found that trades are a chance to make owners do their own thinking because they don't have rankings or ESPN articles to rely on when it comes down to specific trades. This creates the opportunity to extract value because you leave behind all that groupthink and they are forced to make decisions based on their own evaluations. I'm wondering what you see as the most common inefficiencies in leagues. Are there certain areas like this that you tend to see pop up fairly often that might present opportunities? Thanks and keep up the good work. Don't forget to leave my email a rating and review. Wes." I would give that email 5 stars, Wes, and I think that anyone listening to this podcast would as well, and maybe they should do the same for this podcast on iTunes. But I do think that trading is definitely one way to gain that edge because, as you noted, you're able to get these owners who may not be thinking in much detail to have to think in more detail. And when that's the case, there's a bigger chance that they make mistakes. A couple of other things that I've noticed, though. One of them is when there's league format changes. So if you're in a super flex league or something, owners don't always know how to adjust to the supply and demand changes of the game. Like if you're in a super flex league where you're also starting 4 running backs and 6 wide receivers, just as an example, people are going to be so attached to quarterbacks that they still draft them early without realizing that the demand for running backs and wide receivers has also doubled. So you can take advantage of that. And then I also think a huge way to take advantage in casual leagues is finding inefficiencies within a particular site's rankings list. Meaning, when you enter an online draft on Yahoo or ESPN or wherever you're drafting, do your best to spot values that are lower on their list than they should be because you know teams in your league may not draft them where they should. Now, this is a completely made-up example, but if ESPN had Saquon Barkley at 30th overall and you know your league mates are drafting mostly based on that ESPN list, then you should target Saquon Barkley. Brandon Gadula actually does this exercise each year for NumberFire where he looks at our projections versus each site's draft room list and shows you which players are most valuable. It's a great, great article each year. This next one is from Twitter from @example0. Favorite wide receivers outside of the top 20. Now, I've got 3 late-round wide receivers that I'm very, very into, and I'll talk about them more in detail on Tuesday's podcast, but they're Kenny Stills, Randall Cobb, and Rashard Matthews. Stills is now in an offense without Jarvis Landry, and he's been pretty effective as a wideout over his career. Randall Cobb is without Jordy Nelson and has Aaron Rodgers throwing him the rock, and Rashard Matthews has actually exceeded his average draft position by a total of over 120 fantasy points over the last 2 seasons, all while seeing a pretty high share of targets in that Tennessee offense. But like I said, I'll have more on these guys next week when I talk about how to spot a running back and wide receiver breakout. That's just a little teaser for that podcast. This next one is from Twitter from @DavidSobutka. Hey JJ, by no means am I a Cowboys fan, but I cannot help being fixated on wondering who will be fantasy relevant in that passing game. Dak wasn't included in your positive regression candidates, but the passing game has to be better this year, right? Who is a fantasy relevant wide receiver in 2018? As of right now, I think Allen Hurns is the player that you probably want to target most, but there's definitely a lot of ambiguity surrounding that situation. And not only that, but they're not going to be the most pass-friendly team in the league. But regarding Dak Prescott, I think it's important to remember the difference between positive regression and progression. Positive regression means that there's going to be a return to a normal state, whereas progression means a player is going to perform at a higher level altogether. So with Dak, the problem that we've got is that he was just generally bad last year. He struggled last season, or he wasn't as good as he was during his rookie year. But his numbers didn't show that he was unlucky or anything. His touchdown rate, for example, was at 4.5% when he was at 5.0% in year one. That means you're not necessarily going to see positive regression with Dak Prescott. If you want Dak to take a step forward, that falls into the progression category, which is a leap to a different level of play. And to be honest, that level of play is doubtful to be as efficient as it was during his rookie season because he was that good in 2016. This next one says, hey JJ, it's my birthday and so today I am asking about age. What are your thoughts about how the fantasy community looks at players' age? As a jumping off point, I've seen a lot of hype about Juju because Antonio Brown is, quote, getting old. Is that hype deserved for that reason? Thanks. Wiley from London, Ontario, Canada. First off, Wiley, happy belated birthday. I think age cliffs are important, but looking at production and how players are being used is more important in my eyes. Meaning, Antonio Brown is getting older because as human beings, we all get older. But Antonio Brown has shown absolutely no decline in his game. So I don't know why we would care about age if we're referencing redraft leagues as it pertains to Antonio Brown. In most cases, from a redraft perspective, age is kind of a potentially secondary knock on a player. Like if you're between Devontae Freeman and LeSean McCoy in a draft, let's say, then you can use age as a tiebreaker if you want. But I also think that there are a ton of factors that go into a draft pick that having an actual tie between two players should rarely happen. Things are obviously a lot different from a dynasty perspective though. And in redraft, looking at age on the youth side can be important when describing how previous seasons went and how a future season may go. Like, we shouldn't assume Corey Davis will produce as he did in 2017 because we know that Corey Davis was a rookie. In total though, each player is unique in some way. We can use age trends to try and make better decisions, but in redraft leagues, there are so many factors to analyze that we shouldn't end up overusing age as a judgment for success or failure. It's more important to look at how production is trending, in my opinion, and to be honest with you guys, the way production is trending and age will often go hand in hand. This next one says, JJ, I appreciate your perspective on fantasy, and I was curious to know what you think about the trend that is valuing rookie running backs so highly. I feel like we could be falling into a recency bias trap, especially with guys like Ronald Jones Jr. and Sony Michel going in the top half of drafts. My question has two parts. First, is this a case of recency bias, or does the talent and situation of these backs coming in warrant their ADPs, other than Barkley? Second, if the rookies are being overdrafted, where are some opportunities to capitalize on this? Are there veteran running backs out there with established roles that the overall public may be overlooking because they were swept up in the hype of rookie running backs? Thanks, Chris from San Diego. Like most answers that I give, I don't think there's a clear-cut single way to value multiple players as a group. Like, I can't just say, yes, we're overvaluing running backs, because I think it depends on which running back we're talking about. It depends entirely on what their individual situation is. But if I had to absolutely give one answer as to whether or not we're collectively overvaluing these players, I'd say no, I don't think we are. And the reason for that is twofold. First, we know that teams just spent pretty high draft capital on a lot of these running backs. That shows intent to utilize each player. And because running backs can pick up the NFL game faster than other positions, it's not crazy to think that these rookies can produce right away as a result. I mean, we see that each and every season. But when you dig into the individual issues some of these rookie running backs may have, I do think that Ronald Jones is one of the players to be wary about in year one. Not only did he have some red flags coming out of school, like his lack of reception share in his own offense, but the team has already talked about having a split backfield to start the season with him and Peyton Barber. So that's an opportunity for you. At this point in time, you may be able to fade Jones for Barber. I think all of these guys have a decent ceiling though, and that includes Ronald Jones. I'm just a little bit worried about his overall year one situation. This last question is from our pal at Elliot Christ. He says, who has more PPR points in year one, Geis or Penny? So my projections favor Rashad Penny, and it's not just because the Seahawks want to run the football. I think there's legit worry surrounding Geis's pass-catching potential because Chris Thompson is in that backfield as well. And honestly, that to me is what this really comes down to. Right now, I have Penny with 17 more PPR points than Darius Geis in my projections. That's going to be it for today's mailbag show, though. If you've yet to subscribe to the Late Round Podcast, make sure you are by searching for it on iTunes, Google, SoundCloud, TuneIn, and Stitcher. I'm also on Twitter, at LateRoundQB. Feel free to hit me up on there and tell me how wrong I am about things, because that's what people do on social media. I appreciate every single one of you. I'll talk to you next week.